You're listening to the Homelessness Services Association podcast. This is an audio-only version of one of our webinars addressing the challenges of frontline and shelter work during the coronavirus crisis. If you'd like to view the video or look at the slides, please go to hsa-bc.ca. Well, good morning and welcome to HSABC's webinar, Applied Harm Reduction Part 1, Underpinning Philosophy. We'll be running Part 2 next Wednesday at the same time, so hopefully you can join us for that. Pardon me, a frog in my throat this morning. All right. So my name is Sarah Kift and I'm your host for today. And just a little bit about me. I've worked in the frontline nonprofit sector for over 15 years, including in Vancouver's downtown east side at Carnegie Community Center. I develop and host webinars for HSABC, as well as instruct mental health first aid and produce podcasts for mental health organizations here in Vancouver. So when you're using the question section, that's me who you'll be chatting to, and I'll do my best to share your questions and comments with Corey as they come up. I just want to say that it's a stressful time for so many of us, as well as those we provide services to. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time to join us today. Hopefully the content we provide will help you to lead well and with courage in the midst of this crisis. And this is we're hoping to run this webinar again, even if things calm down, because it's a more broad training that is always important. It's not just COVID specific, but we really do welcome your input as we discuss things today, as well as your stories, ideas, and questions. So let's just run a quick poll here. This is just for us to get a sense of where you're at and what you're doing right now in your organization. So take a second to fill this out. I know working in frontline nonprofit work, chances are you might be doing all of these things simultaneously, even if it's not in your job description. And so just choose the one that best represents what you're doing right now. It really just helps us to tailor our content and know who's on the line with us today. I've definitely done all of these things over the years. And I always remember working at Carnegie, and I was trained to do some particulars of my job, but I was kind of thrown into de-escalation and casual counseling and all of those other bits and pieces of frontline work, managing and dealing with people without a lot of training. So I recognize the challenge of working on the front line. All right, so we've got about 45% frontline workers, and awesome, 45% caseworkers or counselors. Great to have you with us today, especially the important work that you're doing, and some support staff on the line. Great to see you as well. And if you chose other, just type into the question section. Looks like we've got a couple of managers on the line as well. Wonderful to have you here also. This is my favorite part. I get to introduce your instructor to you today. This is Corey Ranger. He's a nurse, a public health nurse, and he started his career facilitating a bloodborne pathogens program in the Edmonton downtown core. And since that time, Corey has worked on the harm reduction team in downtown Calgary. He's implemented and coordinated HIV programming in rural Alberta, as well as the take-home naloxone program and supervised consumption services in Medicine Hat. Corey is highly driven and passionate about ethical and evidence-based approaches to public health problems. He has a wealth of experience in both formal and informal education, having acted as an instructor and a coordinator for the practical nursing program at Medicine Hat College. And most recently, he moved back to Vancouver Island and has taken on the role of project manager for the Provincial Peer Training Curriculum Project with the Government of British Columbia. But he's also spent the last 2 months on the front lines in homeless encampments in Victoria, as well as being a passionate and effective advocate for safe supply and a humane approach to harm reduction in the midst of this crisis. And we're really happy to be working with you, Corey, and to have you on the line today to talk about harm reduction. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me here. Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. I really appreciate you all being able to take time out of your busy lives, and so appreciative when I see such a high number of frontline workers, case managers who are attending these webinars on a regular basis. I'm not going to spend any time introducing myself because Sarah did a fantastic job. And whenever I hear her give that bio, I'm like, that doesn't sound like me, but that's really nice that she said those things. But it's about you all here and what can we do in order to support you? What can we do in order to bridge gaps in knowledge? And I want to make sure that we're always keeping the focus on that. Before we do get started today, I would like to recognize that colonization and the institutional oppressors that continue to permeate in our society have dramatically impacted Indigenous people who call this land home. The host of disproportionate impacts towards Indigenous peoples are far-reaching and span generations. There is a significant link between colonization and the topics we're here to discuss today, namely the war on people who use drugs and the disproportionate impact of criminalization, the overdose crisis, hepatitis C, HIV/AIDS, all on Indigenous peoples as an ongoing impact of colonization. I promised myself I wouldn't go off on a tangent during this webinar, but we're one slide in and I'm ready to do that. Today is May 20th. And for those of you who have been paying attention to the news, today is the enactment of the public safety order to decamp the parks, the homeless encampments in Victoria. And if there ever was a more relevant time to make sure that we acknowledge the land that we're on and the Indigenous people who call this land home, today is the day to do so. A land acknowledgement is not enough, not even remotely, when it comes to eliminating those structural and historical barriers erected through colonization. But it is a small step in committing to a relationship of humility and collaboration. So with that spirit today, I acknowledge with respect the Lekwungen people on whose traditional territory I stand on today, and the Songhees, Esquimalt, and Wasanich peoples whose historical relationship with the land continue to this day. If you know which land you're on and you feel like acknowledging that, I would encourage you to type that into the chat as well. This presentation is made possible by people with lived and living experience, particularly in drug use, and them having the courage and the honor to share their knowledge and experience with people like myself. I am not a person with lived and living experience. I don't identify as a peer, but I spend a lot of time working alongside peers. And it cannot be understated the value that peers play in mental health and substance use and public health in order to bridge gaps and support people where they're at. And that's going to be the bulk of what we're talking about today. I'm really grateful that I was able to work on this presentation and develop this presentation in collaboration with ABI and Solid Outreach. And I hope that you all take something away from it today. We will be talking about topics that revolve around trauma, stigma, drug use, overdose, HIV and hepatitis C, and so much more. To many, these topics can be triggering. They also might be a fresh reminder, as this year alone, we've seen a lot of harm and we've lost amazing people to the collateral impacts of COVID-19. I get these texts on my phone whenever someone finds out that there was a death in our community. And I also spend a lot of time on my phone. Now, when I see certain numbers start to show up, I get this physical reaction, like there's this feeling of impending doom. And that's because we've experienced so much loss this year already. It's a sign of the times right now, and it's not okay, but it's where we're at. If you're struggling right now, please reach out. We can't shoulder these crises on our own resilience. It has to be a collective effort and a collective burden. Our plan is to talk about what harm reduction is, where it came from, and what the values and principles that form the foundation of harm reduction work and practice. We also strive to keep you all as up to date as possible with resources. As Sarah alluded to, there are resources available in the handout section here. The Harm Reduction Mythbusters infographic was created by myself, and it's just a really great kind of tool to communicate some of the myths and misinformation that swirls around harm reduction. There's also some really great stuff, including the drug war reading list from drug user activist Zoe Dodd in Ontario. I would encourage people to do what they can in order to read through some of these pieces and really educate yourself, because those myths and misinformations that I alluded to, they create a lot of harms and they slow the development of pragmatic public policy and they impede people from doing what's right in times of crises. So what is harm reduction? Well, harm reduction means a lot of things to a lot of different people. in the simplest of senses, people think of harm reduction like it's just needles, naloxone, and supervised consumption services. But that's a very superficial way of looking at something like this. To others, harm reduction is about the relationships we develop with others, with ourselves, with the world around us. The Indigenous perspective on harm reduction is one that talks about one heart and one mind. Mainstream harm reduction practices like naloxone distribution and opioid substitution therapies have been proven to save lives, but they don't focus fully on substance use behaviors, and they don't address the broader social and health inequities that exist for people, particularly Indigenous people in the first place. For Indigenous communities, harm reduction means reducing the harms of colonization. This means that Indigenous harm reduction is not tethered to the use of substances. Instead, it is a way of life, embedded within traditional knowledge systems that see the spiritual world, the natural world, and humanity as interrelated. Given that these knowledge systems and the way of life, they give to rise something that's been disrupted in our history. And it's important that we always keep that at the forefront of our minds. There's a really great YouTube video from the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society that outlines what the Indigenous perspective on harm reduction is. To others, harm reduction is a public health response to emerging trends and issues that relate to actions and activities that typically generate some forms of harms. But it doesn't focus on the substance or the activity itself as the harm, but the surrounding issues that create those harms, the institutional oppressors that I referred to previously. One of those institutional oppressors is the war on drugs. Prohibition of substances and criminalization of people are systematic forces that oppress people who use drugs. If you see from this infographic that I've posted up here from Filter Magazine, there is something that exists called the Iron Law of Prohibition. And it basically outlines what happens when we start to criminalize certain substances and when we start to make certain substances more difficult for people to acquire. What that typically does is it ramps up the risk and it decreases the quality and consistency of the product that people are taking. Our drug laws still make criminals out of people who use certain substances, which only reinforces a pervasive value system that regards harm reduction as enabling people to behave in intolerable ways. What seems to still not be well understood is that making substances illegal and criminalizing people for using substances actually does nothing to stop people from using it. People have been using mood-altering substances for longer than we've even had police services available, and they're going to continue to use. If you take some time and you do some reading, there's an excellent scientist out there by the name of Dr. Carl Hart. And he talks a lot about the need to decriminalize and the need to stop vilifying people who use substances. And that's where we need to get to, because the war on drugs has definitely been a war on people, and it's been a failed experiment. Canada's first drug prohibition was actually directed towards Indigenous peoples. Alcohol was introduced to Indigenous people by British, French, and US settlers through colonization. When colonizers began to forcibly convert Indigenous people to Christian religions, morals, values, they also advocated for abstinence and believed that prohibition would mean there would be less interracial mixing between white and Indigenous people and less mixed race children. While alcohol prohibition had a short history in Canada, it was actually imposed on Indigenous people for over a century. Prohibition served as legal mechanisms to control Indigenous peoples and nations right up until 1955. As with other forms of prohibition, it didn't actually stop people from drinking, but it encouraged covert and dangerous drinking practices, illegal consumption and selling, covert use, as well as enduring stereotypes and legal discrimination against Indigenous people. We know that Indigenous people and people of color are disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. I would really recommend that people take a look at a book called Busted, an illustrated history of drug prohibition in Canada by Susan Boyd. So what is harm reduction? This definition comes from Harm Reduction International. Harm reduction refers to policies, programs, practices, and aim to minimize negative health, social, and legal impacts associated with drug use, drug policies, and drug laws. Harm reduction is grounded in justice and human rights. It focuses on positive changes and on working with people without judgment, coercion, discrimination, or requiring that they stop using drugs as a precondition for support. There are many instances in mental health and substance use where coercion is used to guide people into certain practices and it creates significant harms. So harm reduction is a philosophy, but it's also a set of practical strategies. We're going to talk more about that, but first, we have to give a brief overview of where harm reduction came from. The history of this movement is really important to understand where we are now with harm reduction and where it needs to go in the future. Harm reduction can be traced back to people organizing in the 1960s against the illegal suppression of drugs and to places in Western Europe, the UK, and New York in the late 1970s and early 1980s. An example of one of the earliest harm reduction programs was the opening of the very first needle exchange program in Amsterdam. People who were using heroin used to buy their syringes from a particular pharmacy, but eventually that pharmacy got shut down. People in that community were worried about injection-related garbage and the growing concern that the new virus, HIV at the time, was not only affecting men who have sex with men, but also people who injected drugs. In response to the pharmacy shutting down, drug users organized to set up a program where people could not only access needles, but bring in their used needles to reduce the amount of garbage that was being left around the community. A couple of years later, an illegal supervised injection site was opened in Amsterdam, and the first legal site opened in Switzerland around 1986. So I really want to stress, and apologies for the brief moment to take a sip of water, I really want to stress that a lot of innovation in harm reduction has come from the efforts and off of the risk of people who are active in their substance use. People with lived and living experience have been at the forefront of driving innovation in harm reduction since its initial onset. They've been doing what needs to be done in the absence of larger systems that can actually put these things forward. And they often do it with very little resource and very little support. So we always need to keep that at the forefront, that the people who have sacrificed themselves are why we are where we're at right now. Why do people use drugs? Well, there's a long list here, but essentially what we need to talk about is that, one, substance use does not necessarily equal addiction. And two, physical dependence also does not equal addiction. A lot of people confuse these terms up and they believe that anyone who uses substances has an addiction. And they also believe that the definition of addiction is that if you stop using a substance, then you're going to go into withdrawal. But that's actually physical dependence. In fact, people use drugs for a whole variety of reasons, and it doesn't always necessarily equate to problematic substance use or addictive substance use. People often use drugs to fit in or to feel part of a social group, to enhance their sexual experience, to enhance work performance, to reduce inhibitions and increase confidence. Sometimes people are just curious, bored, or want to try something new. Some people use it to escape reality or to cope with chronic or situational stress. Sometimes people use it to manage their mental health issues and the impacts of trauma. Some use it because they're in pain. And it's important to delineate the fact that pain doesn't always mean the same thing to me as it means to Sarah, as it means to any of you on the other line. Mm-hmm. Some use it because of dependency, to avoid symptoms of withdrawal. And of course, others use it because they like it. And sometimes drug use is something that people just enjoy doing. If we're going to talk about the root causes of substance use and addiction, though, we always have to talk about the social determinants of health. These social determinants of health influence health of individuals and populations. And it's really important because we have a tendency to moralize drug use. We have a tendency to moralize overdose, homelessness, and even poverty. But what really is within our control? And what does control look like to people who are oppressed by institutional forces? What happens when people don't have a support network, when they don't have gainful and meaningful employment, when their income and social status is so low that they can't seem to ever get ahead in life? When we consider the social determinants of health, we know that substance use and addiction is not something that is just created because someone tried a drug one time. But there's always underlying reasons, that there's always forces pulling people in certain directions. The reason why I really want to focus on this is because I can't tell you the number of people who I've encountered who are in their recovery who will say something like, well, I used to do this and I did this and now I feel better. therefore everyone else should do that. But my situation, even if it looks identical to yours, is not, because we don't have the same upbringing. We don't have the same social support networks. We don't have the same values and belief systems or trauma and history that we carry with us. We don't even have the same perception of pain, whether that's physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. All of that is dependent on the individual. And so you can't transpose one experience onto another's. We have to be able to acknowledge that every single person comes to where they are because of different factors throughout their entire life. I like to think about this example that happened just recently. An individual went away to go to detox, and they went to detox from the homeless encampments in Victoria. And then they were in detox for 6 or 7 days, and then they were discharged, and they were discharged back to the homeless encampment. And the very first thing that they did was they started to consume substances again. And they didn't actually want to when they left for detox. They said that they wanted to take a break. They said they didn't want to use anymore. But what happens when you get thrown right back into a situation where you're back into survival mode and you're only able to meet your very basic needs from day to day? The system failed that individual, and that's why the substance use continued, at least according to them. We also have to look at the role of trauma and ACE scores. ACE scores are traumatic events that can have negative and lasting effects on the health and well-being of an individual. These types of scores, these types of situations can include abuse, neglect, social defeat, mental health concerns, incarceration of a parent. Any person who experiences 4 or more of these adverse childhood experiences has a higher likelihood of lung disease and adult smoking, of drug use, of suicide attempts, of any kind of likelihood to develop depression or liver disease. In fact, adverse childhood experiences are some of the biggest determining factors for the outcomes of health and well-being for individuals later on in their adult lives. Gabor Maté delves into relationships between trauma and addiction. And one of my favorite things that he says is that not all people who use substances have an addiction, but almost every person who has an addiction has a history of trauma and abuse in their lives. And again, it's important to note that trauma is a subjective experience, just like pain is. Even if you had almost an identical situation as somebody else that you see on the street, that doesn't mean that you'll have an identical reaction and response to that. So people who work in harm reduction often do so because they see some of their personal values reflected in the values and principles of harm reduction. I could probably ask each and every one of you on the line, and even Sarah, why did you get into the work that you're into? And if people were feeling safe to disclose that, they would likely disclose that they have some kind of personal attachment to this type of work. I know for myself, I grew up with in a home where there was a lot of substance use, and I naturally gravitated towards wanting to improve outcomes for people who are in those types of situations. And most of us see some. Sorry, Sarah, go on.
For me, it's loved ones and home situation, and experiencing some overdose deaths in the family that has really drawn me into work where. Improving outcomes for people and practicing compassionate care is a really important value to me.
Yeah, I mean, I could probably, I could talk for a long time about it, but really, I came into my understanding of substance use and addiction probably on the complete opposite end of the spectrum that I am right now. Before I started learning about it, I had a very jaded attitude towards substance use, and I didn't really understand very much of it, and that lack of information led to some assumptions and some perceptions that weren't actually true. It wasn't until I was completely thrown into environments where it was happening and I actually got to meet the people who were so quick to label and stigmatize when I realized how wrong I was. And at that point in time, I committed to making sure that I spent my whole adult life being a learner in this process and to be hearing from people with lived and living experience and to really not consider myself to be someone who's an expert, but someone who is always going to be learning And that humility is really something that is tied to harm reduction. You have to be prepared to be wrong, and you have to just be able to learn and adapt and grow with the new evidence and research and education that's out there. Too often, harm reduction is divorced from its radical potential as a social justice approach. Like I said, a lot of people think of harm reduction as needle exchange programs, take-home naloxone, and supervised consumption. But when we do that, we lose sight of the deeper meaning of harm reduction and the values at its core. We risk relating to one another in ways that are not really in line with harm reduction practices at all, or are limited in the extent that we actually can reduce the harm. Harm reduction is trauma-informed care. Harm reduction is housing first. Harm reduction is patient-first language and anti-oppressive practices. When I was working in Edmonton, we used to do education sessions for medical students at the U of A. And we would go there and we would talk to them about harm reduction. And it was always so amazing because we would run these scenarios and we would get these groups of doctors to come up with what the best approach would be based on the scenario that we gave them. And I remember we gave them this scenario about a young woman who came into the clinic who was complaining about tooth pain, who also had hep C and was injecting opioids on the streets and was working in sex work and all these things. And then we asked these doctors to come up with their top five priorities for helping this individual. And by the end, nobody would have addressed the tooth pain. The thing that the patient actually came in for was the tooth pain, but they all wanted to talk about the hep C. They wanted to talk about overdose risk. And it was just astounding to me because those are the types of behaviors that push patients away. Those are the types of behaviors that cause people to be more disconnected with the system. You always want to find out what the individual's priority is and to work on that first and foremost. We're going to spend some time talking about the principles and values of harm reduction, and then we're going to try and reflect a little bit back on these principles and what they actually look like in practice. Harm reduction is based on a set of principles or concepts that make up a foundation of the philosophy, the movement, and the practices. We'll spend a bit of time talking about these principles and then link them to our own values and how we do our work. The nine principles we're going to try and briefly go through were compiled and adapted from the Harm Reduction Coalition in the United States and from Harm Reduction International. We've tried to break them down and change them a little bit so they're less jargony and more accessible to everyone. First and foremost, drug use is a human behavior that many people across the world are unwilling or unable to stop. The second principle is that people who use drugs do not lose their human rights due to their drug use. We're so entitled to rights, and we're so entitled to the rights of life and the highest attainable standard of health, social supports, privacy, freedom from arbitrary detention, and degrading treatment in others. Treating people who use drugs and their families and their communities with dignity and compassion honors their human rights. The next principle is that people who use drugs for many different reasons and in many different ways. I have for you here a model that shows drug use, how it occurs on a continuum, how it occurs on a spectrum. We know that regardless of what substance someone is using or how they're using it, only a small percentage of people who use drugs will actually experience problematic drug use. And we know that a harm reduction approach can help maximize the benefits they get from using their drugs instead of the harms from the criminalization of that. So what would be your response to this model? Are there elements that are missing for you? How could we further compromise or make this model a little bit more problematic? Because there definitely are problems when you're looking at this type of spectrum of substance use. And one of them is using terms like problematic substance use. Problematic substance use and other terms like drug abuse tend to actually put more negative stigma onto the person who's using those drugs. It tends to flip the script and does that moralizing behavior that we've talked about already, where we blame people for the situation that they're in instead of understanding all of the different forces that are influencing that behavior. The next principle is that harm reduction is evidence-based. Harm reduction policies and practices are informed by a robust body of evidence that shows these interventions have strong positive impacts on individuals and community health. Harm reduction is known to reduce the number of infections related to HIV and hepatitis C. The first needle exchange programs, the first supervised consumption services were all implemented due to the HIV/AIDS epidemic that was in Canada. Furthermore, innovation in harm reduction has come from other crises, like the fentanyl poisoning crisis that started in 2015, 2014 in British Columbia and the rest of Canada. Harm reduction is known to reduce the number of opioid-related overdose deaths, to reduce infection from injection drug use. It's also known to bridge people into services. It's helpful in order to establish relationships and rebuild trust between an individual and the health and social safety net that they are so disconnected from at this point in time. These are all things that harm reduction is effective at doing, but it's also effective at reducing community harms. It reduces the number of publicly discarded needles and syringes in communities. It reduces burden on the healthcare system because there's less accessing of emergency department services. There's less money that's spent on treating HIV infections. The cost of treating HIV over a lifetime is estimated to be $1.3 million. But the cost of treating of providing one sterile needle is less than 10 cents. So harm reduction is evidence-based on every level of government, from federal government all the way to just an individual experiencing these benefits. Harm reduction is also non-judgmental. It's committed to meeting people where they are at without judgment. Now, we use that term, meeting people where they are at, quite often when we talk about harm reduction, but what does that actually mean? Meeting people where they're at means that we are coming to them with transparency. We want to know what that individual's priorities are, what their needs are, and we want to know directly from them. We want them to be a part of the conversation, a part of the plan of care, instead of having paternalistic approaches to care and an overall just coercion that happens in health and social services so often. Harm reduction is concerned about the quality of life for everyone, not necessarily ending drug use. And there's been a lot of conversation lately about the idea that harm reduction potentially enables drug use. It's probably one of the biggest myths and misconceptions that exist out there. But we know that's not true. When people put on a seatbelt, it doesn't encourage them to drive erratically at high speeds down a highway. When people put on a parachute to go skydiving, it doesn't encourage them to pull the cord at the very last second. We need to get away from this moralizing behavior because harm reduction really is compassion, and it's empathy, and it's ethics. Harm reduction is also non-coercive. It means options for prevention, care, and treatment must be evidence-based, high quality, and not something that's enforced onto people. Many people who use drugs do not need treatment, and those who want support, such as treatment, should have options to access something that isn't exclusively based on abstinence. I want to pause for a minute and ask you all if you can think of an example of a non-coercive service. There is a lot of coercion that's embedded within the mental health and substance use world. One of these types of behaviors comes from opioid agonist therapy or methadone and suboxone clinics. There are still practices that exist today where if a client comes in and they have a urine drug screen and they show up positive for methamphetamines, that the doctor will take away their methadone prescription. That really makes no sense. And it's a punitive measure. It's controlling. And the meth use has very little to do with the individual's methadone use. And there's no positive benefits out of doing something like that. What will happen is that person will start to experience withdrawal. And if they don't have access to a safe and regulated supply, they'll likely start using street opioids again. The next principle is that people who use drugs must be involved in designing, implementing, and evaluating programs and policies that serve them. There certainly is a lot of tokenism that exists in mental health and substance use, and we often echo these statements about nothing about us without us. but we also don't really walk the walk when it comes to that. Tokenism still exists throughout all levels of decision making. People with lived and living experience are brought onto panels, but when they have concerns or when they raise issues, they're often not heard or their experiences are minimized. We need to make sure that we're not only listening to people who use drugs, listening to people with lived and living experience, we have to actually do what they're asking us. They're the ones with the expertise. They're the ones who have the PhD in lived experience. And we need to acknowledge that and make sure that they are part of the decision-making process, that they're leading the decision-making process. We simply cannot allow for a constant string of failed programs to happen because the decisions are made by people who don't actually understand what things look like on the ground level. The next principle is about social justice. Harm reduction is rooted in a commitment to social justice. What does that actually mean, though? It means that we're committed to addressing inequities that exclude people who use drugs from the supports they need due to gender identity, sex-based discrimination, economic status, colonization, racism, stigma, trauma, and other social oppressions. What are forms of oppression that might create harm? Well, I've described one of them when I talked about the opioid agonist therapy, but criminalization in itself is an oppressive force that creates harm. We've just recently been really fortunate in British Columbia to see some true leadership when it comes to managing a dual healthcare crisis that is overdose and COVID-19. And we've seen safe supply start to be rolled out. It is still full of barriers. It's still not universally accessible to people, but it is a step in the right direction. But if we're telling people that they can have these safe prescribed opioids or stimulants, the next natural step is to move to decriminalization. We can no longer create such a hierarchy of substance use that people who have power and privilege to purchase their drugs don't get criminalized, but those who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic chain are the ones who constantly experience the squeeze. What are some forms of harm reduction policies that we might want to place to mitigate the effects of oppression? Well, I've talked about the need to decriminalize, and we need to make sure that we are capitalizing on some of the changes that have come out of the COVID-19 crisis. It's really shameful that it took a dual healthcare crisis in order to see some really quick changes, because we've been in an overdose crisis for long before COVID was a thing, and will continue to be in an overdose crisis when COVID is no longer a thing. Harm reduction also challenges policies and practices that cause harm. Many policies and practices intentionally or unintentionally create and exacerbate risks of harms for drug users, including the criminalization of drug use, discrimination, abusive and corrupt policing practices, restrictive and punitive laws and policies, the denial of life-saving medical care and harm reduction services, and social inequities. Harm reduction challenges laws, policies, and practices that contribute to harms experienced by people who use drugs. This movement asserts that non-judgmental and practical integrated services can reduce many of the harms of drug use, many of which are not specific to the drugs themselves. Rather, they stem from a lack of legal, unadulterated drugs and access for new equipment. Drug prohibitionist policies and laws are seen as negatively contributing to and exacerbating the factors that they claim to reduce. I remember being in middle school, and we had the DARE program come visit us. Sarah, did you ever have the DARE program?
Well, I was homeschooled, but I heard about it. I saw it on TV.
I can't even remember what DARE stands for, drug abuse something education, reduction education. But essentially, the cool police officers would show up at all of our schools, and they would talk us into going through these scenarios where, you know, we would learn about the dangers of drugs and what's going to happen to you if you use drugs. And if you use drugs, you're going to die or you're going to end up in prison. And then they would take an egg out and they would say, this is your brain. And then they would throw it into a frying pan and Florentine it and say, this is your brain on drugs. It was all very scary. And those scare tactics are things that people to this day still believe to be an effective tool for reducing drug use. but I'm in the age category of 30 to 39. And Canadians aged 30 to 39 are the most impacted by the overdose crisis. In fact, overdose is the leading cause of death for Canadians aged 30 to 39. So if that doesn't tell you that scare tactics and DARE programs don't work, I don't know what will. So here are some values that we might want to think of when we link our own values to harm reduction practices. And these are essentially the core values that we think of when we look at harm reduction. So I'd like you to pick one of those harm reduction principles that we've just discussed. And then I want you to think really hard about what values you see reflected in those principles. And I'm just going to take a moment just to allow you to do that and to settle into it.
You know, something that actually, maybe I'll wait. I'm pretty tender-hearted right now. So we'll come back to that.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I see reflected in harm reduction, it reminds me of one of the very first individuals that I worked with when I was a street nurse. And this individual was living with HIV and Hep C, and they also had severe osteoarthritis to their hip, and they needed a hip replacement. And it was my job to go around with people and to attend doctor's appointments and to advocate for people. And when I went to the doctor's office, I was still pretty green, and I didn't really understand what people were talking about when they said that they were treated differently based on their circumstances. And then I went to the surgeon's office with this individual and watched the surgeon first just berate this individual because of their substance use, and then suggest that they were not going to provide the hip replacement because that person has HIV, and what's going to happen if I poke myself by accident? Clearly, if a surgeon is worried about that, then they're looking for other reasons to not do the surgery. But we worked together, and we worked as a group of three, and we started to do some education every time we got the opportunity. And by the end of the experience, not only was the surgery a success, but the physician and the client became friends, and the physician would visit the client on a regular basis. And so what I see reflected in there is all sorts of things from empathy to equity and wellness to ethical bioethics and treating people with a sense of compassion. Those are all values of harm reduction. That situation in itself was an example of harm reduction, breaking down barriers, advocating for people, meeting them where they're at, and not imposing any kind of judgment on others. So I want you, if you can take away anything from today, is to really think about those experiences, to really think about those principles, and to really acknowledge that wherever you're at, you have the opportunity to apply harm reduction practices and philosophies to your everyday place of work. Whether you're a manager working on policy development, whether you're a frontline worker who's just meeting with people and finding out what you can do to support them, you can apply harm reduction to those experiences every single day. The last thing that I'm just going to tell you about is, before we move on to questions, is that this handout is one of the ones that I alluded to. It is a harm reduction Mythbusters, and it tends to focus on some of the common myths and misperceptions related to harm reduction. The first is that harm reduction enables risk-taking behaviors. But in reality, harm reduction acknowledges that people have the autonomy in order to make their own decisions, and it empowers them to take ownership over their health. Even for people who say, well, if you're going to use drugs, your goal should be to get into treatment, services that are embodied in harm reduction, like supervised consumption services, when people access those services, they're actually 30 to 35% more likely to access treatment services. That came from a study out of Insight in the Downtown East Side. They're also known to significantly decrease overdose, infectious disease rates, mental health crises, and sexually transmitted infections. The next myth that we see is that harm reduction is costly. It costs too much money to operate under a harm reduction philosophy, but that's actually incorrect. when you're looking at bottom lines, you have to acknowledge that sometimes you have to make investments in order to save money in the long run. And if a service costs $1 million to set up, but you've managed to treat or you've managed to prevent 3 HIV infections, well, then that's triple the cost right there. Harm reduction initiatives like supervised consumption services and take home naloxone reduce emergency service callouts, emergency department visit rates. I used to do this scenario with people when we were starting supervised consumption services in Medicine Hat, and because there's a lot of fiscal conservatives in Medicine Hat. And they would say, well, we can't do this. It's going to cost the taxpayers too much money. So I actually had a printout of all of the costs associated with hospitalizing someone related to overdose, the $400 ambulance trip, the $1,500 visit to the emergency department, the $2,400 overnight stay in acute care, up to $20,000 a night if you're intubated in an ICU. Money is not the driving factor when I talk about harm reduction. It's not how my values are reflected in harm reduction, but sometimes people need to know that if you invest in keeping people safe and keeping people healthy, then you get a return on that investment. I often hear people say things like, we need to stop being at the bottom of the river and pulling people out. We need to go to the top of the river and find out why they're falling in to begin with. But the truth is actually that we need both. Someone needs to stay down there to make sure people don't drown, while the rest of us go up there and find out why they're falling in to begin with. The next myth is that harm reduction creates public disorder. But the research has actually shown that harm reduction initiatives decrease public injection drug use and publicly discarded needles. These are backed by decades of systematic reviews, peer-reviewed journal articles, not by things that you'll read on Facebook or in post media. Studies from Insight show that supervised consumption services and other harm reduction services do not create the honeypot effect. They don't pull people into areas. They tend to just meet the needs that already exist in that area. That's one of the misconceptions that we've seen a lot when it comes to supervised consumption services. People say they're implemented in a certain spot and that generates a lot of more negative health impacts. But the reality is that they're implemented in that area because those negative health impacts already existed in that area. Instead of having a supervised consumption service, the rest of the city can be an unsupervised consumption service. And so it really is about responding to need, not about creating it. And lastly, harm reduction is just needle exchange, condoms, and naloxone. But the reality is that harm reduction is both a series of services and an underpinning philosophy that should be applied in all care settings. It's not just about when you're working in community or when you're working in the shelter. Harm reduction should be applied to maternity wards because there's a lot of people who use drugs who are pregnant and they are particularly vilified and punished for those behaviors based off of myths and misperceptions. There's times when harm reduction should be applied to acute care units, to the operating room. We have to understand that it's not exclusive to a small cohort of people, but that everyone benefits from an adoption of a harm reduction philosophy. Harm reduction is also about seatbelt checks, life jackets, car seat clinics, nicotine replacement, and managed alcohol programs. And finally, harm reduction is a way of establishing relationships and rebuilding trust. It fosters connections to services like housing and primary care. Well, that concludes the presentation component of today, but I would like to invite questions. We have time for that. And if Sarah's on the line.
I'm here. Yes, please send us your questions. We've got lots of time for those. Why don't you tell a couple of stories, Corey? I'm having a tough time right now. And I've never done this online before, but this is something that hits really close to home for me. So,
and it probably hits. Yeah, that's okay, Sarah. Yeah, that's okay. I can take it from here. So, I mean, it's obviously from hearing Sarah's reaction, and you might be in a similar situation, and that's totally okay, because a lot of us come to the table because we have had a lot of negative experiences. We've seen people hurting And we often don't know how to bridge that gap and how to support folks in the best way. I can tell you firsthand, in the last 45 days working in homeless encampments, I knew what needed to be done, but I was constantly running up against a system that was oppressive. I was constantly running against a system that didn't actually have the moral fortitude to do what needed to be done. And it created a lot of distress for me. But there's good in all of these things. And sometimes it means that we need to really stretch our advocacy muscles. I remember just a few weeks ago working with an individual in Victoria's homeless encampments. And this particular young lady was being kind of held hostage by her partner. She was dependent on him for meeting her drug use needs. And that put her in a lot of really unsafe situations. And we were really trying to figure out what we can do in order to support this person, keep them safe and keep them connected to the system. The first thing that I wanted to do was to get them onto safe supply. And next week, when we talk about harm reduction and we, in the second part of the series, we're going to talk about some of the services a little bit more that revolve around harm reduction. And I really wanted to get her on safe supply. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it is a new policy that's available from the provincial government that if people are using illicit drugs, a physician can prescribe them a safe alternative to those drugs. It's meant to reduce instances of overdose. It's also meant to reduce the behaviors that people need to do in order to gain access to their substances, whether that's picking bottles or engaging in sex work. But it's also meant to reduce transmission of COVID, because if people can get their drug needs met in a more easy way, then they won't have to resort to going to multiple people and possibly having more transmissions in COVID infection. I ran into a bit of a problem, though, because this particular individual already had a prescriber. And for those of you who have been trying to work your way through the new safe supply guidelines, you know that can be a bit of a hang-up, because if that individual has a prescriber, you have to go through that prescriber in order to gain access to safe supply. And this individual's prescriber was a quote-unquote recovery doctor. And so when I called this physician up and I gave them the situation, what was going on, this physician laughed at me and responded with, "I'm a recovery doctor, not a Dilaudid doctor." And it was really heartbreaking, because we knew what we could do to support this person, but we couldn't take the next step to actually do it. It took about 3 days working with this individual, talking to different physicians, stating my case, and really just continually pushing the issue of safety and the need to support this individual during these trying times. And what we ended up doing was we fired that doctor. We got the individual a new physician. They got on safe supply. And then the same day, they got access to emergency shelter in the hotel system. So we started off in a situation that could have been really heartbreaking. But we ended up, because of some advocacy, because of equity, we were able to meet that individual's needs and get them to a safer place. And now they're doing so, so much better. And they feel supported and are connected to the health system again. So as much as we constantly deal with heartbreak in this field, there are good stories that exist. There are things that happen that support people, and we really need to hold on to those moments. Otherwise, it can be very dark right now.
Mm-hmm. I've got some questions coming up from people. Someone's asking about the fact that they work in social housing, and they're thinking about how harm reduction could be applied to hoarding. Have you had any experience with that, Corey?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is likely, you know, we are experiencing similar issues when it comes to the decampment process that's happening in Victoria, because government agencies are telling people that they can only bring 2 plastic totes worth of property with them. And as we learned from Elaine Guzvik on a previous webinar, Guzvik, people have the right to their property, their privacy, and their people.
And their pets.
And their pets as well, yes. And so it's a difficult fine line, because there certainly is hoarding that exists with people who are in those situations. And what I've seen has worked is, you know, setting people up with some kind of positive reward system, like managing to keep your room clean, you know, provide honoraria or something like that. But in reality, people hoard because they often have never had the opportunity to have something that's their own. And it's a reflection yet again of the way that we treat people. And it's a reflection of just the survival instincts that people have when they are constantly oppressed and they're constantly put in a corner and told what to do. So if there's other opportunities to in your social housing to create a storage room or something like that, where people can still have access to the things that they care about that are important to them, I would definitely encourage that as well.
That's good. I was thinking about actually, we're probably going to be doing another hoarding webinar soon, but we had someone teach last year and he was talking about how clients who hoard, it's usually because stuff is the last thing they have to hold on to, whether it's trauma from losing a loved one, so they're carrying that loved one stuff around, or they've been moved from place to place and they're constantly losing things or having them taken away. And so the minute they have an opportunity to have a place that is somewhat secure, they start to accumulate things because of their trauma. They just want to have a place to have things that are their own. And it might not make sense to you or us as caregivers because we don't value that stuff, but there's usually trauma behind that hoarding. It's important to apply that lens for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when people live their life constantly experiencing loss, they want to hold on to things.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm going to quote unquote hoarding because I don't diagnose people that I don't know. But I think that hoarding like behavior is a reflection of that loss that people experience. And you're right, Sarah, whether it's loss of a loved one or it's actually loss of possessions and your place of living. Some of the folks that I've worked with have been displaced so many times and have lost so many things that they've cared about that they don't even believe us when we tell them that we'll hold on to their stuff for them. They're just like, yeah, okay, we're going to lose it all again.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people talking about hoarding. I'm not sure that Corey and I have the expertise to address some of the psychological ramifications of it. But I am going to pass those questions on to one of our instructors who does have more of those tools. I mean, we have things to say about it, but I think some of these questions might be better addressed to, his name is Richard and he's a great guy. So I'll pass those on to him. Just in terms of harm reduction, someone has a question about supporting clients who have relapsed after a period of time and they're having a rough time with the coming down from their drug of choice. So what I'm hearing in this question is how to support clients who are going through the ups and downs of addiction, really.
Yeah, I mean, so this is like a tip of the iceberg kind of question because it can go so much deeper. And one of the things to say is first and foremost, we need to stop treating abstinence as the only sole marker for success when it comes to substance use. It's a very dichotomous way of looking at things and it sets people up for failure. You know, you can be abstinent for X amount of time, but as soon as you relapse, when we're calling people sober and clean, and when you relapse, you fall into this category that comes with a lot of shame. Even using terms like getting clean can create so many harms for people because if you relapse, does that mean that you're dirty? Mm-hmm. And so I would really work with this individual and say like, hey, you lasted X amount of time. That was really great. What was working for you during that time? What are your goals? What do you want to do when it comes to your substance use? And what are you most comfortable with? And then develop a plan with that person so that you can get to that point. It might not be complete abstinence. It might be more controlled use. It might be experiencing less cravings. And these are things that we need to acknowledge as the priorities of that individual. And then just lean in with a lot of compassion and empathy because these are big experiences for people. And it doesn't mean that they failed. It means that the system is continuing to fail them.
Mm-hmm. I want to take it back to, I think it was one of the earlier slides, and what really jumped out at me was just because people are using substances doesn't mean their human rights are taken away. And that really hit a chord with me. Obviously, I was very emotional. But I also, something else that jumped out at me, Corey, was your shared experience around the change of mind you had around harm reduction. So I'm going to ask you a question, but I'll just preface that with a bit of context. And that is, I grew up in a very conservative Christian home, and there were very strong beliefs and values and rhetoric around drug use. And yet it didn't prevent people from dying. I'll say it that way. People that I loved. And recently, like, I lost someone to overdose, accidental overdose in February of this year, which is why I'm tenderhearted right now. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about that movement, because even as you were talking about harm reduction principles, and even though I've experienced loss in my own life because of a lack of harm reduction and oppression of people that I love and have lost them to substance use that was unsafe, there's still a part of me that it's hard to shake that rhetoric, that moralizing tone, that sense of people not being deserving of care because they've chosen to use substances. Like, I can hear that when I say that as being something that I do not believe anymore. But do you want to just talk a little bit? You know, for me, it was experiencing people. It was actually meeting people and hearing stories and connecting with people around their substance use and finding out what was really going on for them. And then more recently, experiencing some traumatic losses to realize that harm reduction is actually crucial to care in this field. And I wonder, I just would invite you to talk a little bit about your transition as well. How did you get here?
Boy, that's like one of those find the exit maps that you have at restaurants where they're constantly intersecting and running into dead ends.
Yeah.
I lost my first best friend and my first partner to overdose. And I also was in an environment growing up where there was a lot of substance use, particularly alcohol, but not just alcohol. And I actually left those three instances being very jaded towards substance use. And I was really bitter about the experiences that I had and at times the way that I had been maybe not treated the way that I wanted to by someone close to me who was actively using. And it made me put these protective walls up. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what happens when we experience trauma, whatever form of trauma is that our mind tries to safeguard us from that. And sometimes it safeguards us by, us coping through the use of substances. And sometimes it safeguards us by putting up these barriers so that we won't have to experience that. And so, Sarah, when you're talking about those instances that are so close to you, the first thing I have to say is that dealing with these situations when it comes to close family and friends, nobody has a perfect response to that. You can talk about theoretical approaches to things until the cows come home, but when it's someone that you love and care about, a lot of those things just disappear. And they do because we're in our own fight or flight response system. So I came into that whole situation very guarded and dejected. And then I ended up moving to Alberta before I started nursing school, and I wanted to make some money to go to school. So I worked on the rigs for a year. And when I moved to Alberta, I did not plan out very well. I was 18 and stupid, and I ran out of money very quickly, and I ended up sleeping in my truck for the winter and, you know, going to the food bank and connecting with people who I had previously had all of these negative stereotypes about. So I started to shift a little bit there. And then I went to nursing school, and I remember this moment where we were talking about substance use, and I was actually the one that was standing up there saying, you know, it's not a disease, because if you call it a disease, then you're giving people an easy out to act the way that they are. Like, very, very crappy attitude towards those types of things. And then my nursing program, when we went into community health, assigned all of us to different groups and had us go and interact with different populations in the community. And my group was assigned to the homeless population in Southern Alberta. And at first I was really like adverse to it. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to do it. And then I didn't have an option. And my very first day, they stuck me at the intake booth. And it was my job to talk to people and to do their assessment and their history. And by the end of it, I just had, like, even in my first day, so many rich conversations with people that I had previously stereotyped in my mind, that I had this like existential experience where I realized so many of my perceptions were so, so wrong. And as soon as I felt that way, I just started pursuing challenging all of those misperceptions. And from that moment on, like I said, I've committed to being a lifelong learner and to know that I'm going to be wrong often and to be okay with that so that I can continue to grow.
I'm so glad that you took that path, Corey, because a lot of what you laid out today, it was so clear and yet so compassionate. And it's something that I think a lot of us still wrestle with. I also want to say, you know, I have a deep love and respect for people of faith, and a lot of people do really good work and are compassionate and caring and are for harm reduction. So I didn't mean to make a blanket statement there. I just know in my particular context of religious growing up, there was a certain set of values that really was negative around harm reduction. So, yeah, I think the other thing that is sort of coming up is there's so much research and evidence that points to harm reduction as a good strategy. I remember it was a few years ago, there was a set of research that came out around the cost to the healthcare system of people, as you said so brilliantly, either you have an injection site where people can go, or the whole city is one and it's unsafe, right? And so there was some research that came out about the cost of not doing harm reduction in Vancouver. The ambulance rides, the incarceration, the police hours, all of that. And then there was versus the cost of housing people, giving them supportive care and allowing them access to safe supply. And the numbers, you know, were astonishing how much more expensive it is just to not care and to not put these kind of programs in place.
Yeah. And, you know, detractors of harm reduction will often cherry pick certain pieces of data. And one of them was, as we're trying to set up consumption services in Alberta, we were constantly looking over to Vancouver, what was happening in Vancouver. Everything harm reduction related in Canada can become very Vancouver centric. Mm-hmm. Most of that is because a lot of the movement has been born out of there. But it's also important to note that what works in the downtown east side doesn't necessarily always work other places. Like, you can't just directly transpose an exact model onto all of these other places. It has to be individualized to meet the needs of that community. And I remember people saying, like, well, why would you want to start a supervised consumption service? Vancouver has got tons and overdose deaths are still increasing. And that was back in 2017 at the time. And what people, like, that type of data cherry picking is really dangerous, because shortly after, a report came out and it provided an estimate on what the deaths would look like if we didn't have those consumption services in place. And so it didn't acknowledge the fact that the services were being implemented during the midst of an escalating crisis. Mm-hmm. And that escalation, we might have slowed the increase, but you wouldn't have seen an immediate drop off in it. And that's just some of the ways that people will try to mobilize and misinterpret data in order to oppose harm reduction services.
Yeah. So I just want to pick back up here. Please, you know, Corey and I are having a really robust discussion here that I'm finding helpful, but do put your comments and questions and experiences in the chat, because we're here for you. We want you to be able to work through these things and ask your questions and figure out how this applies for you. We have some time for this. So I think the other thing that I've been thinking about is you know, when we do trainings here at HSABC, we always bring it back to, and we're going to get into this, and I will finish a sentence eventually, I promise. next week, we're going to be talking about practical applications of harm reduction. But I just want to bring it back again to this idea of how can you challenge your own assumptions or things that you didn't even know you had assumptions about in terms of care? Or how can you start to test the waters of harm reduction if it's something that's new to you or you have some preconceived ideas or some judgments around it? And I really like what you said, Corey, about you were the person doing intake, or you were in a shelter for a while, you were accessing the same services. And I think that's really crucial, is that we actually start to see people and not substances and not behavior and not numbers. I also want to acknowledge that having been through this myself, it doesn't negate that there's suffering and that sometimes substance use really puts a strain on relationship, and that can be really difficult. As Corey mentioned, he had some trauma around relationships in which people were using substances, and I've experienced that myself. It can actually be really difficult to care for someone when they're in the midst of a substance use addiction. So I just want to say that, because I don't want to gloss over the fact that these things are hard. It's not just that we suddenly decide to have compassion or that we decide to care, or that, you know, it's a checklist. It's actually a human experience that we have to kind of learn through doing it and making mistakes. So Corey, what would you say to someone who maybe this is the first time that they've actually engaged with harm reduction as a philosophy, or as in my case, I thought I knew what it was, and this webinar actually brought up a ton of feelings and challenged some of my assumptions that I didn't even know I had. So what would you say to a frontline worker as one or two things that they can take away from today and apply to their work down the path of compassionate, ethical, caring harm reduction?
First and foremost is educate yourselves. And that's not to say that you are uneducated at this point in time, but just find opportunities to learn more about harm reduction, learn about the history of harm reduction, learn about the harms of prohibition and how it's been rooted in racially discriminatory practices. Take some time to actually talk to the people that you're working with and gather their experience and their insights and really get to know the person behind the label. I do a lot of work with Mom Stop the Harm and Change the Face of Addiction, and they're both advocacy organizations made up primarily of people who have lost a loved one to overdose. I'm sure many people have heard of Mom Stop the Harm and the amazing founders of it, like Leslie McBain and Lorna Thomas and Petra Schultz, and talk to them and learn those experiences, because a lot of them describe that initial process where they were trying to support someone who was active in their substance use or dealing with an addiction, and the turmoil that they experienced because they didn't know the right way to support that person, or they didn't feel equipped to support that person, or they felt like they made the wrong choices, and understand the transformation and the sacrifice that happened that had to happen in order for that transformation to occur. All of those people in those groups have lost someone that they deeply love to overdose or to the harms of the drug war. And they've come to the conclusion that they wish they had taken a different approach when it came to supporting them, because ultimately they just wish that they were still there. And I think that that's a lot of how I feel when I think about my transformation in harm reduction, is those people that I lost early in my life, I spent a lot of time blaming them for the behaviors and blaming them for what had happened. And that was just my way of protecting myself from trauma. In reality, I would do anything to have those people back and to have them still with us. And that means keeping people safe on a day-to-day basis, providing naloxone, meeting them where they're at and trying to operate under a philosophy that supports their priorities first and foremost, to not moralizing their substance use or treating abstinence as the only thing that's going to make them a success, but rather celebrating those incremental improvements, you know, switching from injecting to smoking, you've reduced your risk of HIV infection, cutting down a little bit. Those are things that if that's what the person wants to do, then we should be congratulating them on being able to do it. When we get out of that black and white thinking about substance use and addiction, that's when we really start to see all of the different avenues and possibilities for supporting people and for improving health outcomes for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, you touched on this as well, it's not just up to us as individuals, because we do need healthcare practitioners. We do need systemic changes in order to support the people that we love and are trying to care for. You know, in my case, I have young kids, I have a family, and there were times where it was impossible to support the person that I loved. And that to me doesn't say that I failed. It says that our systems are actually failing. And you've said this throughout the webinar. Our systems have failed people. And so part of our work, when we think about how we could change and how we can support people in harm reduction, is to question those systems, to speak truth to power, and to offer different ways of doing things. Because I can't help someone alone as much as I love them. Or even, you know, maybe it's not a family member, but maybe it's a friend or a client. Like, it's not just all up to me, but we actually need to create systems and communities that actually are doing that. And you've mentioned some of them that are hugely effective. I also want to commend you, Corey, because, you know, during this crisis, you have been an incredible advocate for Safe Supply, and you have made a deep impact on government policy and what's happening right now in terms of harm reduction. And I know that you've done that because of your passion, but also because you've had lots of people who've been listening and willing to work with you to achieve that.
Yeah, it takes a collective. And it's not just about, you know, some kind of touchy-feely. It takes a collective, but it takes a collective of people who are willing to act. And sometimes that willingness to act happens out of need, like in this COVID crisis. And sometimes it comes more naturally and these great changes happen, but they're not going to happen on their own. So while it takes a collective, people of all walks of life, people in all different positions of power and privilege need to start making the next steps and need to push for the next steps. We've made some really great gains when it comes to Safe Supply, but we can't just rest on our laurels and decide that this is good enough and that we are where we need to be. We need to protect our gains, but we need to keep pushing forward because there are still so many people whose needs aren't being met, who aren't being supported in an evidence-based approach. You know, I'm reminded of this individual. He's one of the first people that I got into a hotel. And we got them on a managed alcohol program. And I don't often talk about managed alcohol when I should, but that's because it's not my expertise, as much as it is other people who I work with. But we made all of these positive strides. And then the next day I saw him at the park and I was like, hey, what happened? Why are you here? And he looked at me and said, they didn't feed me. And there was a miscommunication. That person wasn't registered. They didn't get their supper. They felt neglected and they vacated the hotel, left the managed alcohol program and ended up right back in the park. And that was an example of the system failing someone, not someone failing the system. And so it continues to happen, but we need to continue to push to eliminate some of those barriers and make sure that when we're putting people in places, it's because they want to be there and that they have the supports in order to thrive there.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of questions just coming up. People are just grappling with this idea around the drug supply and how just trying to think about how to word this. There's a perception that when we give people funding for substances, we're making it harder for them to beat their addiction. I wonder if you want to talk about that, because that, I mean, that's what we're here to discuss today is, I know that a lot of this is preaching to the choir, but I also recognize that there are real questions people have, and the way to help people along the path to harm reduction is to address them. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so there was once an individual that I worked with in a consumption space who, when they first came to the consumption space, they were overdosing like 7 times in a single shift. And it was really, first of all, most importantly, so hard for that person to be in that position, and also morally distressing for the people who were working in that environment, because a lot of people were like, ah, oh, we just need to, you know, this person just needs to stop using or take a break or whatever. And there was a couple of different options that we could have taken in supporting this individual. The first would have been the standard over-medicalized paternalistic model, which would have meant like, you need to go to treatment. And they would have sent that person to treatment. But because they were forced to go, they would probably be there for as long as they have to, and then they would leave. None of the underlying trauma has been addressed. None of the root causes of that person's substance use has been addressed. But what has happened is that trust has been eroded, and people, that individual will no longer come back to the consumption space because they're going to fear coercive confinement and forced treatment. Instead, what we did was we worked with this person every single day, and we worked with them to find out what would be an adequate dose in order to feel the effects that they're looking for, but not overdosing at the same time. And then over time, the overdoses decreased, but so also did the amount of visits that this person was making to the consumption space. And then they ended up coming in one day and said, I got housed. I'm in an apartment now. And they started talking about going back to work because that's what they really wanted to do. They wanted to work with their hands again. And they felt like they were in a place where they could actually do that. And they did. And that person continued to access the consumption space, but on a much more sporadic basis. And their health improved and their life improved. And their substance use never stopped. But they were in a place where they felt like they were functioning and contributing to society, and that's the only thing that they really wanted. And so in that respect, you know, all of those statements about harm reduction being enabling, we could have had one instance where a person could have dropped their tolerance because they were forced to go to treatment, get discharged, use in isolation, and overdose and die, or a situation where we met them where they're at and understood what their priorities were and helped them meet their basic needs, which at the time, substance use was one of their basic needs, so that we can get them a little bit further up the continuum to a safer and healthier place. And that example can basically be applied to any form of harm reduction, including safe supply. Meeting people's needs, then they stop having to meet their needs by engaging in activities that would typically cause more harm to them, that they're not at risk of adulterated substances that can cause overdose or other negative health consequences, that they have stability in their lives and they know where they're going to go in order to get those needs met so they can spend the rest of their day focusing on other things that make them feel fulfilled and happy. And that's what it's really about. That's what we mean when we say we need to meet people where they're at.
Mm-hmm. That's an incredibly applicable story. Makes me think about how the more shame is involved, the higher risk people are of dying during the overdose crisis. So,
oh, for sure. Yeah. People, you know, often feel like they can't even disclose that they've relapsed because there's going to be so much disappointment.
Yeah.
So their relapse is done in isolation, behind closed doors and public bathrooms. And that isolation is one of the single greatest determinants of overdose death.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience that because of shame and judgment, you know, I've lost someone to the overdose crisis, whereas people who are in community accessing safe injection sites, OPSs, able to talk about and feel heard and not be criminalized or marginalized or oppressed, they actually are safer because they're not using alone or they're not using drugs that are unregulated, that they don't know what's in them. Yeah. That seems like a weird place to leave things. I just want to say thank you to everybody for engaging with us today on this topic. There's a handout of this entire PowerPoint presentation. We'll have that up on our website later, as well as the video recording and the audio via podcast, so you can listen again to this. I know for me, I had a lot of feelings, and so I'm looking forward to reviewing the material again to really get into the principles, because I think that Corey has done a really excellent job of laying it out in a way that shows us the research and shows us the concrete examples. And so I also just want to say, if this brought up feelings for you, that's okay, because we are talking about people. We're talking about people we love, people we care for. We're talking about being human beings. And so this is messy. It's complicated. There's suffering involved. But the whole point of harm reduction is to decrease suffering and to increase connection. Yeah. Any last words there, Corey?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. And so this type of conversation usually elicits some very lively after conversations, post-presentation conversations, and that's a good thing. It's okay to have feelings elicited from something like this, provided you can make sure that you can find some way in order to receive support. But those feelings also are a symptom of growth, because it's challenging our preconceived notions and it's causing us to take a second glance at some of the assumptions that we've made in our lives. And so it's okay if people are going to take this and reflect back on it. That's the whole intent of doing a presentation like this, is to shift paradigms and thinking. And that's really challenging. We hold on to our assumptions and we hold on to our thoughts, because to admit that maybe we weren't completely right to begin with means deconstructing a lot of the values that we live our life by.
That protect us, or we think protect us.
Yeah. And so it's okay. But if you are, like Sarah said, if you are experiencing a little bit of discomfort from this, and if you need to check in with someone, then please do, because there are many out there who have had similar experiences, and we can't do this alone. We can't shoulder those feelings alone. We need to make sure that we have a strong support network so that we can digest this content and we can continue to do the really important work that you all do. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Corey. I'm just putting up a slide of references here. This will be included in the PowerPoint. And as always, please do get in touch with us. This is our website. There's a section for COVID resources. This is where you'll find all of the recordings, the videos, the handouts, and everything you need. You can also email us or give us a call if you need anything or you had any trouble today. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you for the work that you do. None of us are perfect, but we keep showing up, hey? We keep caring and we keep doing the work. And I think that's incredible. All of us at HSABC are very proud of you for being on the front line and continuing to care in that way. And we're also very grateful for Corey. So we hope to see you soon. Stay safe, stay calm, and take a break if you can today. Take care, everyone.
HSABC is a provincial, member-driven organization, and our mandate is to strengthen and unify services across BC that are addressing the needs of those experiencing homelessness. Right now, so many of our members, as well as their friends, families, colleagues, and clients, are facing unprecedented challenges, as well as a total change to our daily lives. and we're here to help support you on the front lines, however we can. You keep showing up, even in the most intense and difficult of circumstances, for the most vulnerable. Thank you for all the work you do and for continuing to do it every day. Our website is hsa-bc.ca, and you can find COVID-19 specific resources for frontline and shelter workers, including handouts, posters, webinar video, news and health authority updates, and much more. You can also email us at info@hsa-bc.ca or find us on Twitter at _HSABC. Stay calm, stay safe, stay strong.